Good evening. This is KGVM 95.9 FM on your dial, or you can stream us at kgvm.org. And this is the Men's Network Radio. I'm James Kosolek, your host, and tonight we are going to be talking with Gary Rowe. Gary Rowe is a writer and a speaker. He's a grief specialist. He's spoken at the Mountains of Courage all about living and dying, dialogues with the living on dying and death. That's annually held here in Bozeman. In fact, they were sponsors of one of our previous shows in early March. And Gary has written several books. And one of the books he's written that really caught my attention was Please Be Patient, I'm Grieving. And it's all about how to care for and support the grieving heart. But let's have Gary introduce himself. Are you there, Gary?
I am here, James.
All right.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Our pleasure.
Oh, well, hello, everybody out there who's listening. Pleasure to be with you and honor to be with you. As James said, I work as an author, speaker. My full-time day job is that I'm a hospice chaplain and a grief specialist, grief counselor. And I do have a number of books out there, and Please Be Patient, I'm Grieving is personally one of my favorites for several reasons. Number one, it's short. So a lot of people like that, you can read through it in probably an hour or less. And I wrote that book by request. People that I was working with in hospice and in the midst of our bereavement and grief program kept coming to me and saying, you know, would you write a book that tells people how I'm feeling on the inside? And then, because I try to tell them and I just can't get it out, and then I can just give them the book. Oh, and by the way, tell me how I'm feeling on the inside, because I'm really not sure how I'm feeling. So as a result of that, you know, I began to work on that, and Please Be Patient, I'm Grieving was the result. And people have responded very, very well to that book, because if you're grieving, all of a sudden you meet this person in the book called The Grieving Heart, and you go, oh my goodness, that's me. That's exactly what I feel. That's exactly what's going through my head, etc. And so people who are grieving resonate well with the book, but also people who may not be grieving right now, but they know someone who is grieving, and they want to better understand them and meet them where they are and support them where they are. Half of every chapter is really about the grieving heart, the grieving person, and the other half is about the person who's attempting to walk alongside them in this, to be helpful to them in the midst of a world that might be kind of unfriendly to their grief, as is often the case.
Well, that sounds fascinating. I'll have to pick that up. I guess you can get it on Amazon, or?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. You can get it on Amazon, and if you want to download a free excerpt, sometimes I recommend that, because then you'll know, yeah, I want to read this whole thing after reading a couple of chapters. You can get a free excerpt on my website, and my website is simply garyroe.com, GARYROE.com. Go to the books tab, and once you're at the books tab, just scroll down to Please Be Patient, I'm Grieving, and click, and go from there.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for that information.
You bet.
Boy, you know, and I was reading a little intro you have on, it occurs to me how your life had a very rough start with abuse, bullying, family and friend deaths, parental divorce, and more. And so you mentioned that at the early age of 16, you somehow went from crises to resolve. And I'm curious, how the heck did you manage that at 16? I mean, you know, what influenced you or who? How did you make it through that? It's amazing.
You know, James, I really can't take credit for it. I mean, I know we all make our own decisions, but it's really the people in our lives that make all the difference in our lives. and the relationships that we have. And even though my family kind of fell apart and was kind of a disaster, at age six, I joined a swim team. And most of my friends were on the swim team growing up, and a lot of the adults that I connected with were the parents of my friends. And so I had this built-in support network that I didn't know I was going to need, but that turned out probably that network saved my life. Number one, you know, if you're in the water 4 hours a day and you're swimming, chances are that's going to wear you out enough that you're not going to get into any serious trouble. It also, exercise is a great way to manage anxiety and depression, both of which I am certain I was struggling with. It's just the swimming managed that. I had a great set of friends who had a great set of parents behind them. And so when things really went south in my family, they were there. And I knew they were there. They didn't offer to do a lot. They didn't need to do a lot. But just me knowing that they were there was huge. Now, one family in particular did do a lot. When I was basically orphaned at the age of 15, and my dad died very suddenly in front of me, and my mom had been struggling with mental illness for a number of years and had been in psychiatric care and had just gotten out of psychiatric care when my dad died. And she came in as the parent to live with me. Then she made a suicide attempt and wound back up into psychiatric care. You know, at the age of 15, I found myself kind of flailing in the wind. Where am I going to go? What is this? And I'd lived in the same town in North Texas for my entire life. So I thought, what am I going to do? And after about a month, one of my best friends on the swim team, who was my age, he and his dad showed up at my door and said, "We want you to come live with us." And they had four other kids besides me, and they just took me in. There was never any paperwork signed. There was never any adoption process or any fostering process or anything like that. I just lived with them. But they embraced me wholeheartedly as a full-fledged family member. You know, I'll never forget that the day I went over to their house and rang the doorbell and walked through their front door. The kids immediately led me into the kitchen, and then there was this island in the middle of the kitchen, and on this island was a big chocolate cake that said, "Welcome to the family."
Oh, that's sweet.
And, you know, the whole, I lived the last 3 years of my life with that family, and it was really about 6 to 8 months after moving in with them that that resolve that I talked about kicked in. You know, going from, if this is what life is like, I'm not sure I'm going to make it, to, well, if this is what life is like, I've been hit enough, I'm going to get hit again. I have to figure out a way to handle the hits of life. And more than that, I have to figure out a way to use what happens to me and turn it around and use it for good. Because if I can't do that, then what's the point of all of this? So that family really probably, and the rest of my swim team family, saved my life, changed the trajectory of my life. And I went from being an orphaned kid that was incredibly lonely to a kid that was really pretty connected to other people, pretty positive, and seeking to heal and grow from the things that had happened to me. So it was a big shift. It was a huge shift.
Well, that's great. I'm glad that you shared that with us, because you know, this is the Men's Network Radio, and it's just a resource for men to get connected with men's groups, et cetera. And I'm in a men's group, and it's really nice to have that support. And so you just told us about all the support that you got and the people that helped, and it really does make a difference to stay connected with the people that are around you.
Yes.
You know, also,
go ahead. Go ahead, James.
I was going to say, you know, you made a point to share your faith and belief in Jesus Christ. And this interview is based on this PDF file that's very current with the time. It's called Crises, COVID-19. And if you go to, is it on your website?
Yes, it is, James. Yeah. If you just go to my website at GaryRowe.com and just scroll down a little bit, you'll see it there. And if not, don't worry. In about 7 or 8 seconds, it's going to pop up right in front of your face.
Pop up, and you'll have a free PDF file. And it's great.
Yes, it's brief, easy to read, mm-hmm. and hopefully very practical.
Yeah. And it's seven principles, which we're going to cover here in this interview. So, but you made it at the beginning, you made a point to share your faith and belief in Jesus Christ, which apparently has an influence on how you handle crises. So I'm wondering, how did your faith give you conviction and confidence as a tool to handle the curveballs in your life?
Oh, good question. And I know that some people who are listening, if you identify yourself as a Christian, I think you'll be able to relate to this pretty well. Actually, even if you don't identify as a Christian, I think you can relate to this. And please understand as I talk about this, this is my story. And of course, during this broadcast, James's intent and my intent is not to offend anyone by sharing what I personally believe. So just take it for what it is. It's my story. And James, with all that happened to me growing up, large chunks of my childhood lost to sexual abuse and bullying, etc. Amazingly enough, I knew that God was real. I just, don't ask me how. I just never really doubted that for some reason. But at about the age of 10, I suddenly decided, you know what, I believe that God is real, but I don't know who he is. I don't know anything really about him. And so in my little brain, I said, well, church is the place you learn about that stuff. So I took myself to church, basically, and found my way into a Sunday school class of fifth grade boys that became good friends at the time. And we had a Sunday school teacher that followed us from fifth grade to sixth grade to seventh grade. And over the course of several years, I'll just say I felt like God spoke to me, revealed himself to me. I put my faith and trust in Jesus Christ. And then, you know, when I share about my faith, I often say, I wish I could say that my life got better after that. But it didn't. The circumstances of my life didn't get any better. In fact, they got worse. That's when stuff really began to go downhill. But the reality of knowing, even at the most difficult times, that God was with me, I didn't necessarily have to feel his presence. For some reason, sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't. But it's just like love, really. It's completely possible for a person to be completely loved by another person but not feel loved. You know, in the same way, God can be right here with us all the time, but we may not necessarily feel his presence all the time. But just knowing that he was there, and then when this family took me in, I can honestly say in that new household, I knew Jesus Christ intellectually. I knew who he was. I had put my faith in him. But in terms of practically experiencing him and his love for me, it really happened in that family. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is real. I have never experienced anything. I did not know this existed. It was absolutely stunning. So, you know, as I say in that little PDF, I just tell people that I identify myself as a Christian and as a follower of Jesus Christ because people deserve to know who I, you know, kind of who I am because I write and speak out of who I am. So that's, I don't know if that answers the question or not, but again, it came down to God being with me, especially in the sense of surrounding me with the people that I needed at just the right time to get me through stuff that I never would have gotten through on my own.
Well, I'm glad you shared all of that with us, because it's tough to talk to people that don't believe in God or are declared atheist or whatever, you know, but there is this force outside of us, I do believe, that is there, and that is that is God, you know. And so, yeah, I was going to ask you, you know, how might you steer someone towards a way or the principles that you use that might help without alienating someone who doesn't share the same spiritual faith as you? Because I see that all the time, where some certain people, yes, you know, they get turned off by if somebody's coming at them with, they say, oh, he's witnessing, you know, or whatever. How do you come in contact with people like that, or how do you counsel them?
You know, of course, come into contact with people of all different faiths and people of no faith. Well, I say no faith. I believe we all have faith. It's just what in.
Yeah.
Even if it's in our own idea that there is no God, or our own idea that there is a God, etc. So I work for a non-faith-based hospice. So my job as a hospice chaplain is to meet people where they are and walk with them in their stuff as much or as little as they want me to. And so that's, and as a pastor and missionary before that, even, James, that was kind of my approach anyway, because I believe that's what Jesus did.
Yeah.
Jesus came and he entered our world. He entered into our life with all of our stuff and walked with us in it. And that's just what I want to do for other people. So in the midst of, for example, sharing these principles in the PDF, the principles are the principles. And I think as we go through them, all the listeners will, you will discover that. It's like, oh, I get it. No matter what my faith orientation is, this applies, because the principle applies to all of us, because really they're just human principles about how to navigate uncertainty and times of crisis in a way that is mentally, emotionally, physically, and even spiritually healthy.
Great. Well, you know, you do talk a lot about grief and mostly with wrapped around death, but, well, you obviously must have had quite a bit of grieving during your early life there, you know, so grief to me is the result of a lot of different circumstances, and it might not be related just to death. So,
yes,
I notice a lot of times it could be into divorce or the breakup of a relationship or loss of employment or other hardships. So,
absolutely,
yeah, how can we observe our grief and move on without depression?
Good question. You know, grief is a multifaceted thing. It's really pretty natural, but we view it as weird. And just because we view grief as weird, because we feel different and we act different when we're grieving. You know, if you look it up in Wikipedia or Webster and you look up the word grief, the definition is going to be something like a natural response to a real or perceived loss. So just repeat that for a minute. A natural response to a real or perceived loss. Not death, loss. Now, we could say all losses are deaths of some kind. We have big deaths, little deaths, but it's hard to compare them. So grief is a natural process. It is not weird. We all have hearts. And when something happens that, I believe one of the bases for grief is when something happens that jostles or even removes our sense of control, we begin to grieve. for example, the current coronavirus crisis. That shakes or jostles, or for some people, really shatters their sense of control. It's like the world has been turned upside down and on its head. That every day we wake up to what looks like the same world, but oh my goodness, it's different. It's very different. And it's that way with any loss. With a breakup, it's that way. With a job termination, it's that way. With a diagnosis that you didn't want and didn't expect, it is that way. With the death of a friend, a family member, a mom, a dad, or sibling, a grandparent, a spouse, a fiance, we wake up to a world that is very, very different. And so loss kind of catapults us into what I call uncharted territory. We've never been here before. We have to somehow figure out a way now to adjust, recover, heal, and grow, even with this incredible loss that we're experiencing, whatever that might be. The simple answer to how do we navigate our grief without diving deep into depression is this. Just give yourself permission to grieve. Sounds simple. It really is simple, but it can be difficult sometimes. And by giving yourself permission to grieve, what I mean by that is there is a bucket full of emotions that come with the grieving process. The two most common emotions people experience are sadness and anger. But in addition to sadness and anger, you have things like shock, denial, being stunned. Everything seems surreal. Fear, guilt, confusion, frustration, irritability, bitterness, blaming. There's a whole lot of things that come with grief. Now, having said that, I would like to say, as a grief specialist and grief counselor, that with most heavy losses, it is natural and common for a person to experience some depression. Now, by some depression, what do I mean by that? Well, let's just, for the sake of clarity, say that there are two main kinds of depression for our purposes here on this show. One kind of depression is what we would call a clinical sort of ongoing depression. The person has become a depressed person, if that makes sense. The depression kind of defines who they are now, and it limits their ability to function the way they used to function. That's heavy stuff. The other kind of depression is a temporary, situation-based, circumstantial depression. Now, what does all that mean? Well, that means I've just been hit with a big loss. I'm sad about it, and sometimes I'm so sad that it kind of immobilizes me. That I really don't want to go anywhere, and I really don't want to do anything tonight. I just really want to sit here and feel sad. You know, we would describe that as that's a temporary, circumstance-based depression. In other words, it came from the loss, and as we grow through the loss and heal from the loss and give ourselves permission to grieve, what happens is that temporary depression changes and eventually fades. Now, having said all that, so give ourselves permission to grieve. Know that this is going to be an emotional roller coaster. The other thing is the number one enemy of a grieving heart is isolation. The number one thing not to do when you have been hit by a loss and are grieving is to isolate from other people. Now, why is that? Well, it's very important, especially when we're grieving, that we stay connected to other people, because other people will make all the difference in our grief process. Some will be more supportive than others. We cannot expect everyone to understand our loss, because if they have not been there and had a similar loss in their life, the best they can do probably is sympathize. If they've had a similar loss, they can maybe empathize with us. But the hard part about grief, James, is that it's just so lonely if the loss is heavy. because each one of us are unique in all of human history. There's never been another person exactly like us, and there never will be again. And if we've lost a fiance or a girlfriend or a spouse or a friend or someone close to us, there has never been another person exactly like them either. And our relationship with them was two unique people in human history having a unique relationship. And so no person on the planet can really say to another grieving person, I know how you feel, because they don't. The feelings are our own, our hearts are unique, and grief is lonely. Thankfully, everybody experiences grief. So even though grief is lonely, if you look around, there's a whole lot of people on the grief road that are traveling along with us.
Yeah.
As you can tell, I could talk on and on about grief, but I'll stop for a breath there.
Okay, because I really like just to kind of highlight that and summarize it. I like there's three or four different points that really hit home, and especially with deep depression. But this all goes back to you had a litany of feelings that you went down.
Uh-huh.
And I could see where some people, they'll bury that. Those feelings,
yes.
And that's where the denial sets in. And then once they isolate themselves, I think that's how the deep depression happens. I'm really glad how you also mentioned, like you did at the beginning with your life, how important it is to have some kind of support. Get out, you know, have some, whether you want to call them friends or acquaintances, whatever it is, a group, a men's group, and all of a sudden
yes.
you have this support system. And like you said, another great point, at least you've got somebody to talk to. There's nothing like
yes.
having somebody's shoulder to cry on. Whether they can understand it or not is so relevant that you could at least have somebody that you can vent or, you know, discuss things with.
Yes.
And then lastly, I really like that point that you brought up that, I catch myself often saying, I know how you feel. Well, it's so true that I really don't.
Uh-huh.
Because I really like the way you put it. Breakup of a relationship, a death, whatever. That person was unique to self, you know.
Yes.
And so that's really, was really, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
If I could just jump in real quick, because one of the questions I get asked all the time is, what do you say to someone who's grieving? And I think people ask that, obviously, because they don't know what to say. And because they want to be helpful. And because they sense they've put their foot in their mouth several times already. And so here are some things to not say. I can define what to say by saying what not to say. And as I say these statements, everybody listening, just say to yourself right now, I will be patient with myself and forgive myself because I've said all of these, probably. I know I have. And frankly, sometimes if I'm caught off guard and stumble, I still mess up with regard to this. But things not to say to a grieving person. First of all, anything that begins with the words, at least. Anything. At least they're not suffering anymore. At least they're in a better place.
Mm.
At least you have them as long as you did.
Mm-hmm.
At least you're still young and you can find somebody else.
Mm.
At least you had other children. I mean, it could go on and on.
Right.
But when we use the words at least, even if our statement is true, it ends up belittling the pain that the other person is in. Even if the statement is true, even if they are in a better place, well, that's great, but I'm stuck here and I want them here with me. Or at least they're not suffering anymore. Well, that's so true, but boy, I am now because they're not here anymore. Another thing to never say to a grieving person is, of course, I know how you feel would be one of them. Another one would be any version of it's okay. It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that is, it will be okay. It will be okay. Yes, that is true. But for the person who's in heavy grief, it does not feel okay. The world is upside down. they might even be wondering if they're crazy and if they're going to make it. And so telling them it's okay feels like a Band-Aid over a grenade wound. And so that kind of bring another thing not to ever say is to assume that grief has a timetable and to say any version of, oh, you're still grieving? Or aren't you over that yet?
Yeah.
Or come on, maybe you should do this or maybe you should do that. When we say our version of get over it, one thing we need to know is you never get over a person. If the loss is a person of some kind, in other words, if it's a death or a separation or a divorce or the death of a relationship somehow through estrangement or breakup, you never get over a person. That's impossible. People are one of a kind and they are in our hearts. So, but we do get through this time of grief. We never get over a person, but we do get through this time of grief. So having said all that, what can you say to a person who's grieving? The safest thing that I've ever found to say is this. Oh man, I'm so sorry. And then you could say, if you're a person of faith who prays, you might say, I'm praying for you, but don't say that unless you really are. And, or I'm thinking of you.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of you via a text, like 6 months after a loss, is like a shot of adrenaline and health into a person. It's amazing what that phrase can do. I'm thinking of you. You don't need to say about what, because they already know, Right. Because that's what's on their mind and heart. So there's ways that we can be supportive. Words are overrated. Sometimes just silence, really all the time, silence, a listening ear, and a hug, at least, well, after we're socially distancing, you know, after that's over, a hug.
Right.
But, you know, silence and a listening ear goes a long way.
Boy, I'm glad you said that, because half the time I don't have a clue what to say.
Half the time I don't either, James. And because, frankly, there is nothing to say.
Yeah.
There really isn't. When we meet another person in their pain, the best way to meet them in it is with kind of a reverent silence, that we are respecting their hearts by just coming into their world and existing with them in their world, even if it's just for 5 seconds. Don't try to pull them out of that world. Enter their world with them, because if you do that, their hearts get the message, oh good, I'm not alone. You know, it's my grief, but I'm not alone.
Yeah, and that's so true. I mean, that kind of chokes me up just hearing you say that, because it is so true, and I think this is the love that we share. This is the God presence
yes.
in us that we can connect with other people. And it
yes.
comes down to love, you know?
Yes.
So.
We are, the one thing about us, we are designed, hardwired for relationship. We come out of the womb screaming for it. We seek it all our lives. And, in my 11 years as a hospice chaplain, James, I have gotten to hear thousands of people share with me their regrets in life. I have yet to hear one single regret that was not attached to a person and a relationship. Not one.
Wow.
Life is about people. Life is about relationships. And when we make it about anything else, we are borrowing trouble for ourselves. We're actually inviting depression to walk through the door.
That's a good point. Well, let's get to some of these principles. You know, in the crisis, COVID-19 PDF, you talk about remaining calm during crises, and you know, crises might be a loss of job or home or due to an illness or a loved one. So how do you stay calm? How do you calm down? That's easier said than done. How do you stay calm?
Oh, my goodness. It is easier said than done. And in the midst of it, the principle just pursue calm. It kind of assumes that we're not going to be calm all the time. I'm fond of referring to the fact that in the Bible, the most often used command in the Bible is fear not. Now, why would God and angels need to say fear not so much? Well, because we have a problem with fear. We fear. And so pursue calm assumes that this is a time of upset, and calm is not the natural reaction here. The natural reaction is to get upset. The natural reaction is fear and anxiety. Those are natural reactions. But we all know just reacting out of fear and anxiety really does us no good, and it doesn't do anybody else any good either. And so what might do us some good in that, principle number one is just to pursue calm. Now, what does that look like? Well, first of all, as weird as this sounds, it means getting in touch with what we're really feeling. I know that sounds kind of touchy-feely, but hang with me on that for a moment, guys. Paying attention to what you're feeling and actually calling it out, as it were, saying things like, whoa, I am really nervous right now. I am feeling really anxious right now. You know what? I'm upset. And I'm frightened. I'm not going to say that to anybody else, but I'll say it to myself. I'm frightened. I'm scared that X, Y, or Z is going to happen. And I'm scared about losing X, Y, or Z as a result of this process. I am fearful. I feel anxious. Just admitting that to ourselves, and if possible, James, saying it out loud so we hear our own voices saying it, it somehow unplugs some of the dread involved. It's like these things have entered into us through the crisis, fear, anxiety. And what we're doing is we're turning it around and getting them out again by speaking them, as it were. I think it's very important to recognize what we're feeling and just being able to say it out loud. The other main way to pursue calm is, believe it or not, and I hope nobody walks away from the radio or turns it off after hearing this, just bear with me, is deep breathing. You know, the beautiful part about deep breathing is that it is a skill that anyone can do. Anybody, because we all breathe. You know, if we're alive, we're breathing. So now, when we're talking about deep breathing, we're talking about a certain kind of breathing. We're talking about a deep breath in through your nose, and then a deep breath out through your mouth. And that's important. EMTs often put it this way when they're dealing with panicked, anxious people, which they often are. They will say something like, smell the roses, blow out the candles. Come on. Smell the roses, blow out the candles. Again, come with me. Yep, smell the roses, blow out the candles. Deep breathing sends a message to your brain, which is in fight or flight mode, if you're anxious or nervous or fearful. Deep breathing sends a message to your brain that says, wait, just hold on just a minute. Things might not be as bad as we thought they were. Let's take a deep breath here. There's a reason why we have that phrase, that idiom in English. Let's take a deep breath. Let's pause. Let's take a deep breath. Because deep breathing actually initiates your parasympathetic nervous system. Your sympathetic nervous system reacts to things, fight or flight. Your parasympathetic nervous system, once you activate it, it sends a calming message to your brain, and your brain sends it on down the chain to the rest of your body. Now, having said that deep breathing is important, what's really important is practicing deep breathing. Most people will not remember to breathe deeply when they're anxious or panicked or scared. That is the furthest thing from their minds. So, like a soldier in battle, You know, when a soldier goes into battle, he's not flying by the seat of his pants. You know, he is moving and shaking and doing battle according to his training. Almost everything is second nature because he's so well trained. In the same way, if we practice deep breathing for just a couple of minutes, say in the morning when we get up and in the evening when we go to bed, just then, if we just did that for 2 or 3 minutes twice a day, then when we need it during the day, after a particularly stressful meeting, before a particularly stressful meeting, before a particularly difficult conversation, or when we've just seen a bit of news that gets our attention, or we've just gotten that diagnosis that nobody wants to get. If we've practiced deep breathing along the way, what we need, that skill will be ready for us to use when we need it. And so a key part of navigating crisis is making the deliberate choice to pursue calm. And we pursue being calm by expressing out loud, if possible, when we're nervous, fearful, or anxious, and practicing the skill of deep breathing so that it's there and ready for us when we need it.
Yeah, I think a good example, if you watch ball players when they're ready to get in the batter's box or big pitch fastball coming or whatever, or a pro golfer before he's ready to hit a shot sometimes, if you really observe, you'll see a lot of deep breathing going on. And that's in athletics, that's a great way to just calm down, you know, and get into the moment. I know I do some yoga practice, and it's all based on the breath and deep breathing.
And the other thing I would say really quick to pursue calm, just as a general thing, is if you can, especially during times of crisis, intentionally be less hurried in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Slow down a little bit. Take your time. Avoid multitasking like the plague.
Absolutely.
It like the plague.
Yeah.
Because it will not help you pursue calm.
That's true.
It just won't.
Well, and even in relationship, I know with my wife, she'll, what are you mumbling about over there? Well, first of all, I'm talking to myself so I can calm down. You know, whatever she told me is making me anxious, you know, and then, you know, just like you said now, you know, it's like, okay, you know, take it easy, slow down, and I'll look at her and say, all right, you're asking me to multitask now. I can't do that. I'm getting anxious.
I can't do that. I'm getting anxious again. Yes, I'm sure every guy is laughing because we can all relate.
Yeah.
That is one thing, gentlemen. Ladies apparently have this incredible ability to multitask a lot better than we do. We just are more singular focused. Although I'm of the opinion that, frankly, no person can multitask, really. Everybody is only doing really one thing at one time with their brain.
Yeah, I think there's been scientific studies
at any given moment.
Yeah, there's been scientific studies on that it's really not that healthy to do that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in these principles, each one you end up with a positive affirmation. So what's our affirmation on the calming down?
Oh, it's just very simple. I will pursue calm.
Okay.
I will pursue calm. Mm-hmm. And what's really great, James, why wouldn't we do that anyway? Why do that just in crisis, right?
Yeah.
So if we pursue, we all know the calmer we are, the better decisions we make.
Yeah.
Almost always.
And this is a key for us guys in men's groups and whatnot. I know most of the men's groups, we end with a... we usually end up with an I statement, an I am statement, or a positive affirmation. It's basically an affirmation like this. You know, what are you going to do now? What's your work for the week? Well, I am going to pursue calm. You know. All right, let's move on to principle two about protecting and nurturing your heart. This is very important, you know. So maybe here you might want to describe how our heart might be under attack, as you say in the PDF, and how can we first protect our heart?
Oh, you're right. This is so important. I really believe our hearts are under attack. By that I mean simply the volume of information cascading in upon us every day. The more we expose ourselves to that, in all of its volume, chances are the more discombobulated we're going to be. but it's not just that. The world does not make it easy for you to be calm. The world does not make it easy for you to pursue healthy relationships. The world does not make it easy for you to not be depressed. The world, it's almost like the entire system of things is moving so fast. It is so furious. It is so frantic and frenetic. It's anxiety producing. And we all end up growing up trying to discover what's really valuable and how do I get my needs met. And we begin to figure that out and develop coping mechanisms and how to meet the expectations of people around us. And in the midst of all of that, for most of us, at some point, our own hearts gets lost. They get lost. Our hearts get buried under all the weight of expectations and responsibilities. And we have enough losses and we have enough dreams go by the wayside that we say, well, that's just impossible. I'll just settle for this and that. And we really forget who we are, why we're here, and we just go through the motions. You know, life is busy. I have responsibilities. You know, I get up and go from one thing to the next thing to the next thing to the next thing, and then I lay my head down at night, and then finally I either get a diagnosis I don't want or, you know, I get older and, oh my goodness, I'm going to die. And it's at that point that I hear the regrets from hospice patients, and what I hear them telling me is, somewhere along the way I lost my heart. Somewhere along the way my heart went silent. I buried it under something. And King Solomon, 3,000 years ago, said, above all else, guard your heart, for it is the spring from which everything else in your life flows. I just want to repeat that. Above all else. In other words, this is the priority, King Solomon, wise King Solomon. This is the end. This is the end game. This is the number one priority. Guard your heart, for it's the guts of who you are. You are your heart. You are not your job. You are not what you do. You are who you are inside. You are your heart. And so the task for us always, not just in crisis, but, you know, in crisis, we need to be especially protective of our hearts. We need to protect our hearts, find our hearts, unearth our hearts, and begin to live from them. And having said that, one way to really protect and nurture your heart, this is pretty simple. My high school swim coach had this favorite phrase, and it was posted everywhere, all over the walls at the pool. He had little cards that he handed out. You know, he had us write it on some of our notebooks, and it was G-I-G-O, G-I-G-O. And that stood for garbage in, garbage out. His point was, you put garbage in, you're going to get garbage out. He used it for nutrition, for hydration, for working out, and for life. He said, you allow garbage in your life. Where you deliberately put garbage in, here's what you can expect. You can expect garbage out. And so if that's the case, how do we protect our hearts as much as possible from the inflow of garbage? You know, how do we kind of guard or at least intentionally choose what we expose our hearts to? And the idea is, over time, the way we can protect and nurture our hearts is less garbage in, more truth and goodness in. Because garbage in, garbage out. Truth and goodness in, truth and goodness out. And the big reason, James, why we need to guard our hearts and nurture our hearts is not just to protect ourselves, but we're in this together. This is all about people and relationships. We are designed to live from our hearts in community together. And so when we find our hearts and live from them, when we protect them and nurture them, it just doesn't benefit us. it automatically benefits everybody else around us.
That's great. And so, you know, you have a list there, if I remember right, I don't have it in front of me right now, of a morning mindset or an identity sheet that you can get on your website.
Yes. Yes. One of the things that I say at the end of Principle 2 of guarding and nurturing your heart is a suggestion I make is just a morning mindset, that when you get up in the morning, you tell yourself the truth about you. For example, things that are true about all of us that we could say, I am unique and one of a kind. I am of inherent priceless value as a human being, apart from anything I've ever done, said, or thought. And if I'm unique, then I have a unique reason to be here and a unique mission and purpose in life. And yes, I've been wounded, but I can heal. My heart is my most prized possession. My heart is who I am. I will guard and nurture my heart so I can live from it. And then I reference an identity sheet that if people would like my, you know, I listed a bunch of things that were true about myself. These are not arrogant things. They're simply true. Actually, these truths should humble us rather than make us arrogant. And I'm offering my identity sheet to people who download the crisis book. All you have to do is email me and say, send me the identity sheet, and I'll whisk it off to you. It's basically a bunch of I am statements, whatever that might be. I am unique in all of human history. I have a mission and purpose that's unique to me. Those kinds of things.
Great. Well, thank you. That's a real gift there, because it is nice to have all those positive affirmations in front of you.
Yes, it is.
I used to do that quite often.
And I still do. You know, first thing every morning, that is what you would think. Wow, after years of this, that you'd have it down by now, Gary. But you know what? We live in a world that challenges all of those truths every day. We have a world that can beat us up silly, up one side and down the other. And so the morning mindset to me is very important. It carries me through the day, and by the next day I need it again, just like breakfast.
Yeah.
You know, if I were to ask someone, wow, what did you eat for lunch 3 weeks ago on a Thursday? They would look at me and go, what? And I would say, well, you need to be thankful for that meal and all the others, because you're alive and healthy because of them. In the same way, the things we feed our hearts on a daily basis, we might not remember what we did on any particular day, but we still benefited from feeding our hearts the truth.
Well, that's so true, because I notice when I'll start my day off with a little yoga session, and at the end of the session, I'll actually bow, and it's like saying a prayer. But I just feed myself with all these, I am intelligent. I pray to my wisdom. I pray to my intelligence. I pray to my love. I pray to my...
Selves the truth.
Yeah.
Because, frankly, we don't need to entrust that to anyone else.
Right.
You know, it's because it's hard to know.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a whole other subject. Okay.
Yeah. Keep it personal, but, you know. Well, that was part one. We got into the first two principles, and this last principle about nurturing our heart, the positive affirmation is, I will protect and nurture my heart. Part two will air next Thursday, 7 to 8 p.m., on the Men's Network Radio, KGVM, 95.9 on your dial, or stream it, kgvm.org. And you can check out the rest of our archive. I think there's about 15 or 16 programs on there now, by scrolling down when you go to the kgvm.org website, and you'll find the Men's Network Radio. I wish you all well during this time of crisis, and may you come out of it stronger as a man and as a leader and as a person. God bless.